Welcome to Prog and Progeny. How are you, Tallulah?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good. I was a bit surprised to see that you came back to Oxford and didn't tell me yesterday.
Yeah, I was hiding from you. No, that's unfair. I got there about 10 minutes before you went on a dog walk. And
okay. Just checking. Anyway, we're not in person, as you can probably tell. Although Tallulah is just down the road. But it's probably just as well because I've got a bit of a cold, so probably best not to do it in person. So this episode, we're almost finished the book, I'm kind of a bit nervous about running out of book. we decided to do a questions episode since we've got a bunch of questions dating back about 3 months, actually, since the last one. But before we kick off, I just wanted to quickly give a shout out to our latest subscribers to Patreon, and I'll tell you about something we're going to do for subscribers in a second. So we've got Mick Bolton, Shamrock Freeze, who I think's real name is Max something. Hello, Shamrock. Thank you, Mick. Thank you, Shamrock. Johan Herald, Andrew Wildman, who I know very well. Andrew, nice to see you're on the old Patreon. I knew you liked the podcast, but thanks for signing up. We've got Ivo Van Velzin, John Harwood, a name I'm going to struggle to pronounce. I think it's Yuri Holt, and Leon Van Oosten. And also I mispronounced a chap called Jan. I called him Jan, but I see he's from Germany. So Jan, sorry about that. That was the last time. Anyway, I'm terrible at pronouncing names. Thank you all for signing up. And for our Patreon subscribers, we've got that Zoom call that we talked about months back. We're going to do it. So basically, I'll send a link out to everybody who is one of our paid subscribers on Patreon the day before. And it's going to be on March the 1st, which is a Sunday at 6 p.m. So basically, anybody who wants to join from our Patreon subscribers can join up. Do a massive Zoom call, hopefully, that won't go wrong, and it'll all be great, and we can answer questions, have a chat, or you can just listen in, just be there. It'd be great to see everyone.
Yeah.
I'll be sending out an email. I'll send out an email with all the details.
Anyway, yeah, and I'll post it on our social media accounts as well. Before we crack on with the questions episode, we came across, who was it that sent you the Mick Wall podcast?
I think it was Mark at Marco's Marillion Museum. Mark's always sending me stuff of interest. There's a podcast. Both Tallulah and I listened to this podcast by Mick Wall and John Hotton, and they're probably listening to this now, thinking, oh, they're talking about
us. Is it going
to
become like a back and forth?
I don't know. But I thought it was, well, there was a few inaccuracies, and Mick kind of, a bit rude, basically accusing me of not telling the true story about the meeting to get Fish to rejoin the band for a tour. The reason why the story is completely different to how he remembers it, because it was a different meeting. I had a meeting with Mick Wall, he's right, in Wantage at a Thai restaurant called Yummy Thai, I think it was called, wasn't it, Tallulah? You used to like that restaurant.
Yeah, well, he said a Thai restaurant and I thought it's definitely Yummy Thai.
Yeah. Yeah, because Mick used to live, I don't know if he still lives there, but he used to live in Didcot and I was living in Uffington at the time.
There was a big thing about how you met him halfway and they were saying it shows Mick's, you know, place
status.
And respect, status in the band. And I was thinking it's just because you would meet anyone halfway, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I wouldn't expect somebody to just come to me, like, you know, being summoned or something.
I mean, you're not that famous. You can't.
No, but even if I was, I wouldn't behave like that.
No, I know. No, you're quite humble. But did Mick have a good status in the band?
He did. I mean, he wrote the first biography of the band at a time, really, when, I mean, people comment a lot about my biography being honest. And, you know, talking about a lot of things that people don't normally talk about in biographies. And Mick's biography was completely the opposite of that. It was a real gloss over job, you know. There was none of the bad stuff was included. None of the difficulties, none of the arguments, none of the criticisms.
They did say that. They said they liked your biography because it was very honest. And
yeah. So I'm not criticizing Mick for that. It was just at a time in the band's career where everything was glossy and fun, and you know,
he did very much idolize the time, the pre-H era, the Fish era.
Yeah, and I think Mick was sent to meet me by a guy called Merck, who used to work for Sanctuary and then went on to be somebody at Universal. And then he did some private equity thing for buying up publishing contracts. Anyway, so I think that was the guy behind Mick's overtures to get the band to reform and do this this tour with Fish. But, as I said to Mick at the time, I would have considered it, but I knew there'd be a lot of resistance within the band from various quarters. And not just Steve H, because I think Steve H, at previous times, as I mentioned, there was a time when Fish approached us about doing a tour together and a time when we approached him. So we all considered it at one time or another. So it wasn't out of the question, but at the time, I think it was, we'd kind of moved on, really. When I met with Stuart Galbraith, which was after the meeting with Mick Hall a few years later, again, talking about reforming to do a tour, I was sure that I didn't want to do it and nobody else in the band wanted to do it. So, that's how I opened the book with that story. So that's why it's different, Mick. It's not because I was lying or not because I couldn't remember the truth. I got it all wrong. It's different meeting.
Is this early 2000s?
When I met with Mick, I was going to say it was probably maybe 2010, 12, something like that. I can't really remember. It was definitely before Stuart Galbraith, which was in 2015.
They called the split between you and Fish a tragedy and said you would have been massive if you'd stayed together.
Quite possibly. But at what cost? I don't think even if we'd stayed together for another album or two, it wouldn't have lasted long term. We wouldn't have been together 30, 40 years later, that's for sure.
No. You know?
I think split happened at a good time, really, when you consider how things turned out. Well, for us, anyway.
Do you accept the blame?
Us splitting up?
Yeah.
No, I think, well, maybe. Maybe I'm to blame for it happening when it did. But I don't think it would have, you know, at some point, somebody else would have either quit or wanted to split with Fish. I mean, Steve Rothery left the band at one point because of Fish and then rejoined, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So there was definitely a lot of difficulty in our relationship with Fish, and it wasn't just me. I was just the one that had the big mouth that said stuff. I've always been a bit like that, though.
Yeah, it's weird because you're quite shy, but
I know, because what happens is I bottle it up and I keep my mouth shut until I can't stay quiet any longer, and then I just have
very
to
healthy.
I know. And then I just say everything.
And then you just
say
get
too
really
much.
Angry.
Yeah, I get really angry and I say too much, and then so it's kind of the worst possible way.
I can do quite similar.
Yeah, rather than just kind of dealing with it at the time, saying what I think, I wait until I have to build up a good head of steam to get over my shyness. You know, that's what it is.
Mm.
Yeah. So, should we get on with the questions?
Yeah.
I think the main reason why they're a bit critical of me, a bit pissed off with me, is because they asked me to go on their podcast or to do something with them in London a few years back, and I said no. Oh, well.
Well, I was going to say, should we get Mick Wall on?
We could do.
They said you're a very nice guy.
I know, I am. Okay, so here we go. First question.
This is from Tom Bailey. Which songs can the band pull off on the fly with zero rehearsal or preparation, barring any equipment necessities, of course? On a side note, I've asked H the same question on his podcast. He did give his answer, and the first song he named off was Man of a Thousand Faces, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, well, I'll comment on what H said, I think the reason why he suggested Man of a Thousand Faces, because it's kind of, you could just pick up an acoustic guitar and start strumming it and playing and singing it. So in that sense, it's pretty easy. But if you mean, could we just pull it off on the fly with the whole band playing the full band album version, I wouldn't class Man of a Thousand Faces as that sort of song, because of the ending is much more involved and complicated. There's a time signature change in the middle, which can be a bit tricky sometimes if we haven't rehearsed it. But there's plenty of songs we can do, with the band just playing. Funnily enough, I think a lot of the old songs are easier. I think it's one of those things that when you're young, your memories that get formed more permanently than when you're older. Yeah. So the early songs, even if we didn't play, I know, let's say a song we haven't played for years, like He Knows You Know, I could probably just play that now with no problem. But if you asked me to play something from Happiness Is the Road, for example, that we haven't played for years, I'd have to listen to it to remember how it goes. Yeah. So, but, you know, a song like Garden Party, we often play that off on the fly in the sense that we haven't rehearsed it. And we just decide as an encore one night to do it, and we haven't played it for a year or two, and we just do it, and it's fine. Or Easter is another one that usually we could play with zero rehearsal. So there's quite a few, I think. There's also a lot that we would really need to listen to remember how they go.
Another question from Tom Bailey. Does the band have a daily group text amongst themselves? I know this. And if so, who posts the most annoying memes? Didn't I change the name of this group chat to Lucy's Bitches or something?
Yeah, that was it. Yeah, we've got a few, actually. We've got Marillion Band. We've got New Album, which is basically the band and Mike. I think Rich is in that. That's Richard Lee, our tour manager. Then there's the Marillion Chat, which is the band, Mike, Lucy and Rich. And that's the one that you changed to Lucy's Bitches.
When we were in Cornwall and we were having breakfast and Dad had just discovered, well, my boyfriend actually introduced Dad to Ed Gemini AI, and we photoshopped him as having 10 empty pints in front of him and looking really drunk at about 10 a.m. saying, really looking forward to tonight's gig, lads.
Yeah, so I think the answer to your second half of your question is it's me that posts the most annoying memes. But we all post jokes and stuff as well. It's probably me that posts the most stupid memes.
Yeah, no one replied to that either.
I think Lucy liked it.
Did you? Yeah. Did you? What other memes have you posted then, off the top of your head?
Oh, I can't remember. Nick Davis has got me on a joke group chat on
Nick
WhatsApp.
Davis, who we had on.
Yeah, so he's constantly sending me jokes. Every day I get at least one joke from him. Some of them are quite funny. And some of them are completely unplayable.
Right, next from Ronald Scrimjaw. Have you ever asked Rick Wakeman if he would like to do an album with you?
No, I haven't. funnily enough. I think it would be a bit weird doing an album with another keyboard player. But he'd probably say no anyway. if some lowly keyboard player asked me to do an album with them, I'd probably say no. So,
you would do an album. And
I did think about who I might want to do an album with. Because Steve Rothery has done an album with Steve Hackett. So they're two guitarists, Tallulah, just so you
know
Steve Hackett.
Yeah. Genesis.
So, yes, exactly. They've recorded an album together, which is coming out later this year. So I'm curious to see how that works together, the two guitar players. But yeah, it's possible.
Do they have a band?
I think they've got Ricardo, who's the Ricardo's a keyboard player that played with Steve Rothery on his solo stuff. But he also is a recording engineer, mix engineer. So I think he's the keyboards and recording guy behind it. So I'm curious to hear it. I did ask Steve last night if he wants to share a track or two with me so we could talk about it, but he didn't. He said he's not ready yet. So Ron also asked, have you ever tried singing, Tallulah? could see you and your dad doing a song like Dave Gilmore did with his daughter, Romany. Who? Oh. So, how about it, Tallulah?
I do sing. I'm just a bit shy about it. I sing and play the keyboard. And I do want to do... we've talked about doing something together for ages.
But we haven't yet.
But we haven't. So, well, it's kind of hard because I'm in London and Dad's... I mean, I'm in Oxford at the moment. And Dad's in Oxfordshire. So
that shouldn't be a barrier. Okay,
no, we should do something.
Let's try it.
And we'll put it out to the subscribers.
Right, that's it. You heard it here, Tallulah.
Andrew Glennon. Has the band ever come close to breaking up since H joined? That's a really good question.
There's been a couple of occasions where probably we've come closer to it than we've realised at the time, you know. There's a period that I recount in the book when we were in Portugal around about 2012, which kind of, we almost broke up. We didn't see each other for 6 months after this argument, so that was bad. That's the worst I think it's ever been. We literally had a big fight. And if you want to know the details, you have to read the book. But we had a big fight and then we all flew home from Portugal.
We're going to cover the details, surely.
Yeah. we all flew home from Portugal and then nobody spoke to anybody for 6 months. And then the only reason we spoke to each other again after that was because we had a tour that was booked. So we had to get together to rehearse. And so we all turned up at the Racquet Club to rehearse. And in typical English style... we didn't talk about the argument. We just carried on as if nothing had happened. Yeah.
And then you've not spoken about it since?
Not really, no.
Well, that is very unhealthy. There's a lot of... So you think you all need therapy or something?
I was going to say, Tallulah,
are
you offering your services?
Group therapy.
Every time I tell you a story, you go, oh, that's really unhealthy. That's not good.
Who was the fight mainly between, without kind of going into what it was about?
Have a guess.
You and H. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, we've both mellowed a lot and we both have much more... We've got a great relationship now. We did have a few years where things were a bit tense between us. When I say a few years, I mean like about 20, but...
really? You know. Maybe it's just your problem then, you and lead singer. Maybe you want to be the lead singer secretly.
Yes, move over. I can do that. No, it's not, it's not.
It's like not I said, my I problem.
It's just my big mouth, that's what it is. I say things that I should just not say. Or... it's not even not say, but not say it in the way that I say it or at the time that I say it. Maybe it's a valid thing that I want to say, but the way I say it is wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. So definitely that was my fault. Didn't need to be like that. But that's, you know, at least we didn't split up. There was another time actually where we were on stage. It was the second last gig. I can't remember which tour it was. I wish I could remember. But H just started messing about and doing like singing Jingle Bells and stuff. It was a Christmas tour because he started singing some Christmas songs, like just random stuff. And I'm like,
was he drunk?
Probably. We came off stage and I said something about him singing Jingle Bells, and he just exploded and got pissed off with me. And then we had another gig to do, but we didn't speak to each other in the sound check. And then we did the gig, went home, the tour was over. And then by the time we saw each other again, it was fine. But if it had been at the beginning of a tour, it might have ended differently. But that's the two worst times I can think of. And both of them weren't really like a big thing. It's not like...
Not talking for 6 months is kind of crazy.
Yeah. Well, it's because I suppose because
did the band take sides then, or did
no? I think just... everybody just we all just split and did our own, you know, just everybody just went off and did our own thing. We were supposed to be writing an album, so we kind of just it was like I think the general feeling was because there was such a bad feeling about what happened, that there was no point us trying to get together and work together while everybody was so upset about it. So the best thing to do was just not do anything, which was probably a wise move, because when we were with Fish, you know, when things were bad, we went and locked ourselves away in a castle in Scotland, which was probably the worst thing we could have done.
Yeah, I mean, it's understandable in a career like yours that you would need a break from each other, because it is really intense. It's kind of healthy to have, like... I bet there are some bands who have no kind of social interaction, just when they're not working together, don't speak at all.
Yeah, there's a question about that we got, which we haven't got to yet, which was somebody was asking about how much we know about each other. Because it was something along the lines of they were surprised to see that I didn't realise that how close H came to not joining the band. Well, I did know that. I was just kind of, for the purpose of the podcast, I didn't want to, you know, if he's telling a story, I'm not going to... Yeah, did I?
You said that it really was a battle to get him to join. He was being very hard to get.
Yeah, but I knew that. I knew that he was thinking about doing this, the tour with Matt Johnson or whatever. So, you know, for the purposes of the podcast, I'm not going to interrupt him and say, oh, I know that. I've heard that story, you know.
Shut up. Back to me.
We do know a lot about each other, for sure. You know, we've been together for 40 years plus, so...
Would you consider them some of your best friends?
Of course, yeah. Andrew also asked, have you ever been badly ripped off in a business deal? If you count our record contracts, yes, but otherwise, no.
He recorded the question with a D. Trump voice. Have you ever been badly ripped... No, that was more Godfather. Sorry, God. Sorry, God. China. No.
China. We can't include this.
No.
I'm going to America in a couple of weeks. If I say anything bad about Trump, they won't let me in.
It might not be let in.
We've had a couple of gigs where we didn't get paid, but that's about it. Maybe our EMI contract was a bad business deal, but we kind of walked into that.
You absolutely have. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, but we walked into that with our eyes open. It's not like they changed the terms of the contract once we signed up, you know. Well, our eyes open, but with no experience. That's the problem.
Daryl Box. Do you have a long-standing road crew, and do each of the band members have their own road crew member who just look after their gear?
We do, and yes, we do. Both yes to both of those questions. So we've got Phil Brown is our sound engineer and has been for a long time. He kind of started off as our monitor engineer, and then he kind of moved on to Outfront Sound. So for people that don't know what that means, monitor engineer is the person that stands at the side of the stage and mixes the sound that the band hears in their in-ears, whereas the Outfront Sound is for the audience. And then there's Jens on the lights. He's been with us for a long time. But each band member has their own crew member. So I've got Tommy. Tommy is Marcus's son. Marcus is Ian's drum tech. So we've got like a family thing going on. Yeah. Steve R's got a guitar tech called Steve as well. The crew, I mean, we have had some changes over the years, but they do stick with us for usually a long time. You know, it can be 5, 10, 15, 20, depends who it is, really. We've got Ollie doing the monitors. He's from Italy, and a nice young lad. He's really young. He's probably 22 or something, but he's really good. And so it's like a big family, really. And Rich our tour manager, Richard Lee, Frenchie, as he's known. I don't know why he's called Frenchie, but that's what we've always called him. He's probably been with us for about 30 years. He started off as Ian's drum tech, actually. So that's kind of what happens. You know, people move around different jobs.
This is from Gavin. No surname. What is your favourite gig and why?
That's a tricky one, really. I've always liked Hammersmith Odeon. I think it's just because it's where I used to see bands when I was growing up. So it felt like a real achievement playing there. And we played some great gigs there.
Soon, aren't you?
Yes, it's called the Eventim Apollo these days, but it's the same building. But yes, we're playing there in September. Two nights. But it's a great gig. I love that place. But it's just a theatre, really. But if I had to choose one, I mean, the Royal Albert Hall's amazing. So you can't really beat that as a place to play. And it's just fabulous. Mm. But there are some gigs around the world that we've played that are also really nice. It's not just in the UK.
What's your favourite abroad location?
Years ago, we played this place called the National Auditorium in Mexico City, which was a great venue, a huge place with really good acoustics and a great layout, because it was like the stage was at the bottom of a sort of fan-shaped arena, you know.
Are you looking forward to playing Pompeii?
Yes.
For that reason, yeah.
Yeah, should be really special, hopefully. Mm. There's a lot of nerves going to be happening that night, those two nights, because we're filming it, and you know it's and it could be really hot as well, so there's that worry that
true.
You know, so we once played a car park in Buffalo, New York State, in the middle of summer. It was like a big open air thing in a car park, and it was so hot, all the gear started melting, like my keyboards like there was like blisters appearing on the plastic surface.
Oh my god!
They were just it was really bad.
Paul Lazinski, it's unique that essentially you have two keyboard players in the band between you and H. What would you say the main differences are in your approaches, and is there anything that H brings to the table that you feel you might not have, or is he mostly another set of hands to fill the parts live?
I think we both have different approaches to playing. So I think, I would say H's contribution, apart from being another set of hands, which occasionally is needed, but mostly his contribution is when it's a song that he's composed the music to go with his singing, and he's playing it and singing it at the same time. Like, for example, a song like Fantastic Place. You know, it's him playing. It's obviously, he's kind of made the music fit with what he's singing, and then he plays it, so that makes total sense, you know. Or even a song like The Party, which we had a question about, actually, or people commenting on it, I should say. It was on YouTube. I mean, I'm not going to talk about all the questions and comments on YouTube, because there's loads, but I just thought it was interesting that people have such a different way of seeing things, you know. Like, so they were talking about Holidays in Eden and saying the part, and this guy said The Party is the best song on the album, who had the idea? And then somebody else went, oof, hard disagree, it's one idea, four chords rising on a piano stretched over a pretty tedious 5 minutes. So there you go, there's two opinions about the same song. And I can kind of see why the guy would say the second thing about it, because it is four chords. But then I made the mistake of saying, apparently, I can't remember saying this, but I said that Chelsea Monday wouldn't pass the quality control today because it's only four chords repeated. And this guy then said, this song is a masterpiece. Whether it has four chords or more, I don't care. It has a beautiful atmosphere combined with Fisher's hypnotic storytelling. And the guy's right.
Quite a few songs are four chords repeated.
Yeah. Exactly.
Quite a few.
I think the point is, and I kind of want to take back what I said about Chelsea Monday, because if it was just about how many chords a song's got, then there's loads of great songs that you would say aren't any good. So it's not. It's a completely intangible thing that you can have a song that's four chords and be really boring, or a song that's four chords and be one of the best songs in the world. So it's kind of, and it doesn't even need to be what's, you know, the notes that are played or how good the person is that's playing it, whatever, you know. That's what makes music so interesting, I think, and what makes songwriting so difficult, that you can have all the right, what appears to be the right ingredients, you put it all together and it makes a shit cake, you know.
Yeah.
And then other times, you know, the same ingredients, you put them together in a different way and you have a masterpiece. So it's really interesting.
Yeah.
I think really the main thing between H's playing and mine is that we've worked out a way of not stepping on each other's toes. We both play and we're both comfortable with that, you know, and it works really well. You know, never a point where he says to me, not do that. Can you play it like this or whatever? You know, now and again, he says, I really love that. Or that bit there is just great. You know, and sometimes he does stuff and it's that thing about the four chords or the part that you play. You hear something that somebody does and you go, oh, that's really nice. And then you work out what it is and you go, oh, that's it. It's just that, you know, and it kind of, it doesn't take the magic away, but it makes you realize that how people hear music as a listener can be completely different to how somebody who's performing it feels about it, you know.
Andy Truscott, to both, is there anything in your life that you wished you had done differently?
Well, Tallulah, here's your chance to tell me.
Oh, God. My life hasn't been very long yet. I mean...
Yeah, you've got plenty of time to make mistakes.
To be honest, I kind of wish I hadn't gone to Cambridge. I mean, okay. I didn't love it.
Yeah.
But I'm glad I did, because it's a good university, obviously. But I much preferred the degree I just finished, which was in London, my master's. Yeah.
I do think from time to time about your time in Cambridge and how difficult it was with the whole lockdown thing. And it wasn't a great experience for you, was it?
No, it wasn't the best experience. I mean, I met some really lovely people, and obviously the studying is, you're taught by world experts, so it's, you know, that's great. But yeah, it was hard as well. Yeah.
Mm. Well, they say that Cambridge and Oxford students study for about 45 hours a week compared to...
Oh, yeah, I was probably doing more than that.
Yeah, it's a lot.
So, anyway.
Where shall I start? I can think of a whole list of things that I would have done differently. But, you know, they say you shouldn't regret. No, you can't change the past. So...
That's such a cop-out. That. I said one.
It's hard to say, really, isn't it? Because if you do something different, let's say you had the chance, it's that thing, isn't it? If you had the chance to go back in time and choose a different path, there's so many good things that would be different that you wouldn't have in your life. So thankfully, I haven't got anything where I've gone, oh my God, if I'd had a chance to do that again, I would have not done that, or I would have done this, you know.
Yeah, neither do I, really.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've had a pretty charmed life, really, so I'm not gonna risk going back in time and changing it. And
oh, no, neither. Now I'm regretting my decision.
Yeah, exactly. So, no, let's keep it as it is. And learn from the things that we wished we'd done differently rather than actually wishing, if you know what I mean. Right, sure. That's my therapy session over. This is a good one. This talk about blast from the past. So this guy, Simon, said, do I remember Stephen Walker, who was a friend stroke hanger-on of the band in 1982? Now, the email said...
What's a hanger-on?
You know, somebody just hanging around with the band, like a fan... A fan that you can't shake off. Well, actually, this guy, I didn't remember him. I didn't remember the name. But then, Simon shared a picture as well. And I recognised him and I remembered him then. And he was the boyfriend of Laura, who's Fish's sister, for a short period. So that's why he was a hanger-on, because he was going out with Laura. And and he was a nice guy. I remember him. I kind of vaguely remember him. I couldn't say I've got great memories of him, but he seemed like a nice guy. He was on our very first Scottish tour when we were travelling around the pubs in Scotland. He was helping us out a little bit here and there. Apparently, Fish offered him a job, but there was no pay in it. It was just work. So he turned it down.
Martin Gebbett, have you ever gigged alongside the Psychedelic Furs, my second favourite band?
Well, you're in good company.
Could you drink your wine then?
Cheers.
It's 10 a.m.
You're always going on about my drinking, Tallulah.
Sorry.
No, I'm afraid it's just water. So Psychedelic Furs, H loves the Psychedelic Furs, or used to back in the 80s. So I've never listened to them. It doesn't sound like my sort of thing, if I'm honest.
So you haven't gigged alongside them?
No, we haven't. Sorry, that was the question, wasn't it? but, yeah, no, I'm not aware of their music at all. Maybe I should check them out. Alex Rose, is it true that while Marillion were recording Brave at the Chateau Marowat, in a moment of high drama and extreme volume, the side of the castle fell off? What do you think? So it's, it sounds like a...
And it resulted in the band having to take on the repair work themselves.
So there was, as always the case with these tabloid press stories... I think this was actually in Q magazine. It had a grain of truth. There was a wall that ran down the side of the castle. The castle was typical, built on a hill with like a moat type thing, and the wall ran around the outer keep, and part of the wall collapsed into the moat. But it was nothing to do with us. It was just probably wear and tear after centuries of being a castle.
A too heavy a jam session.
It wasn't us, I don't think.
Philip Mosley.
Who apparently is somehow related to Ian.
Well, I was going to say.
I think he's his dad is Ian's cousin or something. Go on, carry on.
Why wasn't the release on Season's End, aside from the remaster in 97?
I think it was a bit of a throwaway song in the sense that we kind of just... that piece of music, the release, was something we were kicking around with Fish before he left the band. And then we used it as a kind of audition piece for people to attempt to sing along. You know, when they come for an audition, we'd play them that and ask them to sing something over it. And I remember the chap who we auditioned called Carl Sentence, who sang with Geezer Butler, sang something pretty good over that, actually, which almost convinced him that he could be the guy for the job. So it was kind of kicking around for a few years, and I think it never got taken up by H when we were working on the album. And then when we needed a B-side, I think the lyric for the release was something that H already had. So it was kind of, we were just basically trying to cobble together a couple of B-sides. And I suppose it is quite commercial sounding.
Right.
But it was too late to go on the album, you know, and probably, I'm not sure we would have wanted to put it on the album. Mm. It's a bit like, Cinderella Search actually was from just after the Fugazi sessions, and that should have gone on Fugazi, but we hadn't written it in time. So, and that ended up being a B-side. So it does happen that we end up writing something that should have gone on the album and doesn't, for time reasons usually.
Yeah. Right, well, there's still quite a lot, but I'm going to suggest we stop there and do another episode soon.
Okay, so, yeah, let's do that. We do squeeze in a bonus episode of just questions just for the Patreon subscribers, because they're...
Sure.
It's their questions.
Sure. Okay, right. Cool. Well, thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dad.
And hit subscribe, click the button, whatever it is that people do.
Yes, come to Patreon. Follow us on Instagram and YouTube.
Yeah, Tallulah's quite proud of the fact she's getting more Instagram followers now.
They've doubled in the past month.
That's great.
Great. Thanks, Dad.
Thanks, Tallulah. See you soon.